This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. 30 years ago, the Portland Trail Blazers were the NBA champs. On Thursday, the team decided to solemnize the anniversary with several undoubted bargains, the best of which was the selection of Ohio State center Greg Oden with the first pick of the 2007 NBA draft. Joining me now on the line from Portland is Joe Freeman, who covers basketball for the Oregonian. Joe, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's start with the selection of Greg Oden. I understand that yesterday the city held a rally at which Oden was present, so I guess I don't need to ask if Portland's excited about the pick.
Yeah, Portland is ecstatic. I mean, in addition to the rally, you know, the previous night on draft night, they had a big party down at the Rose Garden, the arena where the Blazers play, and there was almost 6,000 people there. And after the announcement was made that the Trail Blazers were indeed selecting Greg Oden, the fans stormed the court as if they had just won the NBA championship. So it's 1977 Redux there, all in one announcement by NBA Commissioner David Stern.
Most teams would probably have made that selection at number one and then packed it in for the remainder of draft night, but Blazers GM Kevin Pritchard followed by adding a total of 8 new players to the roster. He even traded troubled forward Zach Randolph to New York. Which of Thursday's moves do you think will most help the team?
Well, getting Greg Oden without a doubt is the centerpiece to future success here in Portland, and you also can't overlook the jettison of Zach Randolph. While he was a talented player who scored very well and was good at getting rebounds, he carried a little bit of off-the-court baggage, shall we say, and the culture of the Blazers has changed over the past couple years, which Kevin Pritchard has been no small part in. And I think fans, and I think especially Blazers management and coaching staff, think that's more addition by subtraction than anything else. And I wouldn't be surprised if there's going to be more moves on the horizon here over the summer. Free agency starts on July 1st, and then things go from there. So there should be some more trades in the works, I would think, this offseason.
Well, this means that he may be trading away the people for whom he's just traded, I guess. But I gather what you're saying is that the era of the Portland Jailblazers is, in fact, over now.
Yeah, you are correct. I mean, you really saw that happen a little bit last year. You know, last year they made NBA draft record 6 trades on draft day. So it's been 2 really active back-to-back drafts for the Blazers. They acquired a player who ended up being the rookie of the year in the first round, and Brandon Roy, a player from the University of Washington, and then another all-rookie first-team player, LaMarcus Aldridge from the University of Texas. And those 2 players, and then you add Greg Oden to the mix, all 3 of those guys not only are very talented players, but they're also really highly regarded people and real good characters, if you will. As much as Blazers management and Blazers fans would like the Blazers to get back to winning on the court, they as much value the character as well. And just in getting to know Greg very briefly through interviews and news conferences and stuff, he's a very humble guy. He's self-deprecating. He's humorous. He's amiable. He's everything that Blazers fans long for, and I think they're really going to kind of cling to this guy and really value him and embrace him as a Blazer.
Well, all those splendid qualities notwithstanding, this team was terrible a couple of years ago. How quickly can Portland become a contender?
Well, they had the worst record in the NBA, not this past season, but 2 seasons ago. They did improve by, I think it was 10, 12 games over the year before last, so you saw a little bit of improvement. I think this team can contend for a playoff spot, maybe, you know, the last playoff spot in the Western Conference. One thing to keep in mind is it's very young and up-and-coming team. I mean, like I mentioned, 3 of the key players are either going to be in their second NBA season or just their first. And there are other young players as well on the roster that makes it one of the NBA's more young and up-and-coming teams. So Blazers fans are going to be tempted to really, really long for immediate success, but they're going to need to be patient. I mean, it's going to take a little bit. There's a learning curve, obviously, for players in the NBA, and it's going to take a good 2, 3, 4 years before they really get to that elite caliber of the league, at least I would presume.
Well, Joe, based on the tenor of our conversation, I feel a little bit silly asking this question, but is there anybody out there in Portland who's thinking maybe the Trailblazers should have taken Kevin Durant or, I don't know, Tiago Splitter?
There is definitely a segment of people who definitely prefer that the Blazers pick Kevin Durant. There was an online poll that the Blazers did on their website, and it was a good 2-to-1, about a 2-to-1 ratio that Blazers fans wanted Greg Oden, but that still left you know, a segment of the population that wanted Durant. He is a phenomenal player. He's the only freshman in NCAA history to be named the National Player of the Year. And he, a lot of people feel he could come into the league next year and be the eventual Rookie of the Year, that he may have more immediate success than Greg Oden. But Greg Oden is 7 feet tall. He's very athletic. He's very well-rounded. And where he brings even more effect to a team and more skills to a team that would help a team win would be on defense. He's a strong defender, a shot blocker, rebounder, and all that stuff. So, immediately there might be some national, wow, they should have taken Kevin Durant, hindsight kind of deal. But it's one of those deals where it goes back to waiting 2, 3, 4 years. I think what you're going to see at that time is that a dominant center is going to carry the Blazers further in the long run.
Joe Freeman covers pro hoops for the Oregonian. He joined me on the line from Portland. Joe, thanks for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me, Bill. Take care.
Yesterday in Valencia, Spain, Alinghi won the fifth race of the 32nd America's Cup to take a 3-2 lead over Emirates Team New Zealand. As in 2003, there is no American team competing for the America's Cup, but Alinghi does have an American helmsman, Ed Baird, and New Zealand is using an American tactician, Terry Hutchinson. So either way, America wins, right? Right? Here to help answer that and other very important questions is Stuart Stroily, senior editor of Sailing World magazine. Stuart, welcome back to Only a Game.
Oh, it's great to be back. It's been a few years.
All right, let me be sure that I've got this straight. Alinghi is a Swiss team defending its title on the home waters of Spain, while the Emirates team New Zealand is sponsored by and takes its name from the International Airline of the United Arab Emirates. Is there any point in speaking of this event in terms of competing nations anymore?
Well, it depends on who you ask. I think the New Zealanders are quite a national team. 14 of 17 are New Zealand natives on the boat, and the team draws quite a bit of support, both financially and spiritually, from the New Zealand public.
Mm-hmm.
And, the New Zealand government's into the team for a good portion of their budget, not quite as much as Emirates is. But on the other side, there is only one Swiss sailor on the Alinghi boat. Alinghi loves to tell you how many Swiss people are on the team, in terms of the shore crew and the designers and everything else, and that's certainly a significant portion. I think it's more than any other nationality. The New Zealand team has the good fortune of being able to pick from a very talented crop of sailors. New Zealand is dominant over here. There are more New Zealanders competing in this event than any other nationality. They're spread across a number of the teams, and so that certainly helps them. The Swiss team is a very international syndicate, and they went out and got the best people for the job, regardless of where they were born and what passport they carry.
Last time around, the New Zealand team had the hula, a technological experiment that didn't work, although it was supposed to give the Kiwis the edge, but they lost in 5 straight races. Are there any interesting technological advances to speak of this time around?
Not quite. This time around, there was much less opportunity to hide stuff. The boats have been what we call unskirted, which means that when they're pulled out of the water, there's nothing shrouding the underbody, which, of course, is the only thing you can't see when they're sailing. So it would be a lot harder for teams to have something like the hula. I mean, the hula, no one had seen it until the skirts were pulled down right before the Louis Vuitton final, so that didn't give teams much chance to try it out. This time around, if you want to try something unique, you're pretty sure that the other 11 teams are going to copy it as quickly as they can and see if it works.
So far, the competition has been relatively evenly matched. No race has been won by more than 35 seconds. It's a huge contrast to last time around when New Zealand didn't even finish a couple of the races. Has this been a good contest so far?
Bill, it's not even it's not just a huge contrast the last time. It's a huge contrast to the history of the America's Cup. You look back through the Cup and there have been, the number of races that have where both teams have had a chance to win it, you can count them on one hand, maybe just a couple of fingers. So this has been a phenomenally exciting event. It's really, it's a godsend for the sport. I think a lot of people had expected this to go 5-0, just like the last three had gone, and like many of the other ones in the past had gone.
Earlier this week, each team was asked to lower its mainsail in compliance with safety regulations. New Zealand did so. Alinghi complied only after sending a crew member up the mast to attach a halyard. New Zealand protested, saying that this wasn't exactly in accordance with the rules. What was that all about?
Well, there's a safety rule that there's been a couple of injuries that have happened in rough seas when they've sent people aloft to help take down a sail. The mainsail is actually locked to the top of the mast. So to release the lock, you used to have to send somebody up the rig, but that's a little dangerous. You know, 135 feet in the air when the boat is pitching about in the waves, that's quite a bit of motion. So now they're required to be able to release the lock remotely from the bottom of the rig. The thing with the Lingi is that if they did that, the sail was just going to come sliding down because they didn't have any line attached to it. The bottom line with this, I think, is something that we've seen in numerous cups, is that when you see an opportunity to make the other team do a little bit extra work, you take advantage of it. You know, the deposition required four of Lingi sailors to come in on their day off and spend some time talking to the jury and sorting this out. And I think that if even though they lost, New Zealand, they won a little bit in this protest.
Lingi is up 3-2 right now, needs just 2 more wins to take the cup. Will they successfully defend their title?
You know, it's interesting. Lingi won race 5. However, in my mind, the series is actually more even now than it was before the race started, because most of the people here, most of the press, and a lot of the observers had assumed that Lingi was slightly faster in the expected sea breezes we'd see here, normally see here in late June, early July, which is 12 to 14 knots, and that the New Zealanders had an advantage in the lighter winds, 8 to 10 knots. But yesterday's race was in a fair amount of breeze at 12 to 17 knots, and those are conditions that people have expected Lingi to outperform New Zealand, and that wasn't the case at all. New Zealand was every bit the match for Lingi in this race. They were just as quick upwind and downwind. And given that we may see some more of these conditions, I think this series is as even as it could be. You know, just that Lingi needs one less win to snatch the cup back.
Stuart Stroily's podcasts from Valencia can be found at sailingworld.com. Stuart, thank you very much for joining me.
Hey, Bill, I'm happy to be on the show and looking forward to another 4 good races.
It's 19 minutes. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, a very loud competitive sport. But first, over the past week in Indianapolis, the Poets Laureate of various states met to consider sports poetically. Baseball and basketball, boxing, bowling. No, I don't think bowling poems are where these folks want to go. Anyway, now they'll return to their home states to write poems about what they've witnessed. The result, they hope, will enable their readers to see poetry as part of life rather than part of school. Joining me now from the studios of WFYI in Indianapolis are Indiana's Poet Laureate, Joyce Brinkman. Joyce, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
And Marjorie Wentworth, who is the Poet Laureate of South Carolina. Marjorie, welcome.
Oh, great to be here.
Joyce, you came up with the idea for this year's gathering of Poets Laureate. Why did you decide to meld the generally incongruous worlds of poetry and sports?
I guess there were several reasons, Bill. And I did come up with the idea, but the poets did decide that they all wanted to do it, and they were pretty enthusiastic about doing it. One, because, as you just said, we wanted the kids to understand that poetry is not just something that you have in the classroom. It's not something that's boring. That's really part of life, and it's your opportunity to record your observations about life. And so that was one reason for doing it. And we also see some parallels between sports and poetry. From the standpoint of the discipline of both sports and poetry, and as poets, you know, we enjoy playing with words just like people in sports enjoy playing with different kinds of balls and bats and all those fun kind of things. So we really wanted to kind of relay that fun to the kids.
The Poets Laureate were all asked to come to this week's event with some sports poetry in hand, and I understand Marjorie brought a short piece which you can share with us?
Sure thing. You want me to read that now, Bill?
I'm ready.
All right. It's called Skiing. Sliding across the rim of the world, through sun-washed air, past snow-coated evergreens, woods filled with swirling prisms of splintered light caught in ice, endlessly multiplying into silence that flows suddenly inside you.
Wait, that was stunning.
Well, I wanted it to feel like you were skiing. Thank you.
Yeah.
You don't get to go skiing much in South Carolina, you know.
No, I can imagine not. A work of the imagination, indeed. Now, I'm curious, Joyce, did anybody come to the meeting saying, hey, look, I'm sorry, I tried, but I just can't write poetry about a sport?
Absolutely not, Bill. They all wrote sports poetry before they came, and they were, again, very enthusiastic about it. And my local poets have been working with kids in different sports poetry clinics, like baseball poetry clinic and swimming poetry clinics and all kinds of different sports. And those kids have been writing sports poetry. And we just came back from recording a CD where the laureates have read the poems that they had sent in advance, and some of the kids have read the poems that they wrote in the sports clinics. And so, you know, we just think that's a great opportunity, again, to let those kids be on the stage with the laureates and know that that they have the opportunity to create something that's meaningful.
Mm. One little boy said to me, I feel so special today. Everybody's making me feel special. And that's great. That's how we want them to feel, that they can do this kind of thing.
Have you got a kid's poem you can share with us?
Oh, gosh, Bill, I don't think we brought any of the kids' poems with us. We actually left. When we left, we still had kids back there recording.
Still writing and recording. I probably couldn't stop them.
Yes.
Yeah. But they did quite a variety of things. We had you know, soccer poems, and, of course, we had basketball and baseball. And so we really had quite a variety.
A little bit of everything.
Yeah.
When people think poem about sports, it seems to me they're likely to come up with Casey at the Bat, which
if I
don't ever hear it again, it'll be okay with me. But my own favorites run more toward Donald Hall describing Ted Williams in the outfield of an old-timers game as a lame truck horse. Did that one come up for discussion?
Actually, we didn't discuss any existing sports poetry per se. We just basically, you know, tried to give them a sports, as far as the kids, give them a sports experience and then help them take that experience and put it into words. You know, when we talked to them about rhyme, they had beach balls or balloons or something like that they were batting back and forth to each other.
Competitive rhyming.
Sort of, yes. A little bit of competitive rhyming.
I like it.
And then whatever sport they were doing, if they were swimming, they would be swimming in the pool, and we would, you know, we would have them listen for the sounds and think about putting sound into their poems. So, you know, we really tried to immerse them in the sport and have them learn something about the sport as well, and then try to put that into a poem.
Is it your best guess that 2 weeks, 6 weeks, a month hence, these kids will still be writing something? Or was this kind of, hey, yeah, we came, we had fun, and then we'll go out and play baseball again?
I think it's like any kind of experience when you're working with a group. You know, not everybody in the group is going to necessarily carry something forward, but I dare say that in each one of these groups, each one of these clinics where one of these local poets wrote with these kids, I think that there are going to be a couple of kids who are going to say, really relate to the writing experience, and it's going to not have just been fun for them, but I think it's going to really help enrich their lives. Another thing is that there have been studies done that show that poetry really helps kids in school. And strangely enough, it doesn't just help you with English. It helps you with math, too. So it's just really, we think poetry is just so important for children.
I'm going to have to take your word for that because it never helped me with math. That was a dead loss. Joyce Brinkman is the Poet Laureate of Indiana. Joyce, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much.
And Marjorie Wentworth, Poet Laureate of South Carolina, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Bill.
For some sports fans in North Carolina, summer can be a long, hot wait between the excitement of the NCAA basketball tournament and the distant crunch of the football season. But one group of competitors has filled that void for the past 39 years in Spivey's Corner, a hamlet south of Raleigh that boasts a population of 448. As Ron Schachter reports, that's something the winners, losers, and the spectators can shout about.
Thank you. Thank you.
The National Hollerin' Contest, held each June in the middle of North Carolina's tobacco country, is, like any local fair, part contest and part cultural demonstration. There's plenty of barbecue and gospel and country singers who entertain from a stage in front of the corrugated metal wall of the Spivey's Corner Volunteer Fire Department. But hollerin' is the main event. Some of this year's contestants have been training for most of the past year, working on breathing, timing, and endurance. Many practice outside on their farms, others inside their cars on the commute to work. But they all share the goal of making the most of the 4 minutes they have to compete for a national championship. This contest is almost 4 decades old, but it celebrates a tradition that dates back hundreds of years. And in case you think that hollering is synonymous with calling in the hogs, the participants in this year's junior competition will tell you different.
My great-grandpa had different hollers for different things. He would holler like this to get everyone out of bed in the morning. Or my grandma Millie. She had 10 kids. She needed a way to locate them on her farm. She did it like this. Another type of holler is called a distress holler, and this is if you were in trouble or hurt, and it sounds like this.
This year's women's division winner and 3-time champion Sheila Fry says hollering can be downright ladylike.
Ladies were like the cornerstone of the family, of the household. The husbands relied upon them to communicate back and forth. They had to communicate with the children, and they didn't have cell phones, so, I mean, they had to holler.
But the men's division contains the heavyweights, whose competition begins hours earlier at the registration desk.
How much time got left, Jasper?
Okay.
Got 3 minutes. All right.
3 minutes.
2-time champ Kevin Jasper from Knoxville, North Carolina, has been coming here for 10 years, and has a strategy.
This year, I'm going to try to be last. Be the last one up there. Because you register in numerical order, and they call you in numerical order.
Jasper, a computer programmer, didn't grow up on a farm. He learned hollering mostly from a recording of Sampson County Classics.
I sing, you know, sing in church, and I've sung the national anthem for Winston-Salem Warthogs baseball games once or twice each year for the last 4 years. And so I enjoy a vocal challenge. So I kept working on it, And what I did was I re-recorded what was on that CD onto a cassette tape, because I had a cassette tape in my old car. And I recorded some of those hollers like 5, 6, 7, 8 times in a row, so I could listen to the ones I wanted to learn how to do that many times in a row and try to imitate it as I was driving.
Jim Grasty from Fayetteville is also a 2-time hollering champion. But today, he's worried about his allergies and sinuses.
I've had it happen a couple of times where kind of all of a sudden you're building up and you're getting that crescendo, and all of a sudden it just kind of goes off nowhere. You know, it just kind of fades away on you. And I said, whoops, let me try something different here. So you sometimes can't tell what you're going to get, like Forrest Gump in the box of chocolates.
Grasty takes a larger view of hollering, which he learned to do growing up in South Carolina.
Run into folks from out in the Midwest, a lot of the farm folks out there, and of course, they're spread out on the farms and stuff, and they're accustomed to hollering. So hollering really is kind of a universal thing from pretty much around the world. I've heard various kinds of hollers and calls worldwide. You know, like one of the things you hear now, a lot of days you hear about the calls to prayer, the prayer calls over in the Middle East. That's a type of holler, and it's a form of communication.
In today's competition, he takes the audience as far as Africa. But it's Jasper, with his own embellishments to a local holler, who takes his third men's crown.
Oh,
This festival has drawn the attention of outsiders from the Library of Congress to Charles Girault, and the winners appear on the Letterman Show. Hollerin Contest founder Ermin Godwin, who has just turned 80, helped put Spivey's Corner on the map.
I will venture to say that if you go over this country and pick out 10 points anywhere you want to, Crossroads, Village, New York, anywhere you want to, and pick out 10 people and ask them if they know where Spivey's Corner is, and they will know.
Still, there's growing concern about the fate of this tradition. It used to be that a winner wasn't allowed to compete again, a rule that changed as the ranks of hollerers dwindled. This year, the men's and women's divisions each had 7 contestants, down from the dozens years ago. Contest coordinator Wayne Edwards, who's also the assistant fire chief here, says he's still encouraged.
These people that are entering these contests, they're career people. They're professional people. College degrees that want to come back, be a part of history. And then even this younger generation, you know, if you were back that stage a few minutes ago with the junior hollering going on, you saw some of the juniors actually producing and doing the old-timey hollering. That tells me the hollering contest is going to continue.
For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Spivey's Corner, North Carolina.
If you're interested in listening at your leisure to Only a Game, to my weekly commentary, or to longer versions of my conversations with authors, athletes, and experts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcast. You're listening to Only a Game. Regarding my commentary in the June 16th program, Dr. Margaret Duggan, a WBUR listener, wrote, "Thank you for your comments regarding Duke Lacrosse. The young men involved have been painted as the victims for so long, and surely they were victims of a terrible justice system, but the women they hired were surely victims also. Very few people seem concerned with that, or with the degrading way the boys treated the women. I cannot imagine how I would feel if my son or daughter felt comfortable treating any other human being like that." In last week's program, Charlie Pierce and I commented, amusingly I thought, on the way the National Hockey League has slipped from our consciousness. A gentleman who identified himself only as Tim, a former listener, was not amused. He wrote, "I changed channels after being bored to tears today listening to your show. By the way, the NHL draft is going on this weekend and you blew it. I know you subscribe to the old adage, I destroy what I do not understand, right?" That's an old adage I hadn't heard, actually, but in any case, since what the NHL has done to itself hasn't quite destroyed it, the league probably has nothing to fear from Charlie and me. David Cobb, who hears Only a Game on Vermont Public Radio, emailed in response to our coverage of the National Football League's conference on head injuries last week. "Helmets have turned a great game into football follies," he wrote. "The old game was played right. Today they overhit with helmets and it shortens careers." I wonder how far back you have to go to find football played without helmets. And finally, Dr. David Warren of Miami, Florida, emailed this week to respond to last week's story about skiing in Dubai. "How sad it is," he wrote, "that with today's energy crisis, global warming, and our youngsters dying nearby, that Dubai has created an indoor Black Run level ski mountain with throwaway clothes. In summer, in the Northern Hemisphere, there are naturally beautiful places to ski in Chile and Argentina. I volunteer to cover that story if you'll just send me there. Love your show on mostly big people playing mostly children's games." You can send your comments on the program to us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu, but the easiest way to reach us is through the website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And Indigene Pharmaceuticals, maker of Relaxane, a non-prescription product for relieving the symptoms of everyday stress. Available at Rite Aid, GNC, and Duane Reade. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a story to make every golfer who's seen his drive slice into the woods feel lucky. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The first two picks in the NBA draft Thursday night offered no shocks. Charlie, at what point in the process were you first surprised?
First of all, I was surprised at the ninth pick when Joakim Noah showed up dressed like somebody from an ice cream company's version of Guys and Dolls. I think things went pretty much in the way people thought. I thought Memphis took a perfectly respectable chance taking Mike Conley as early as they did. Looking up and down the draft, a couple of things surprised me. The first being that if they can keep him off the ganja man, Sean Williams to the New Jersey Nets makes New Jersey a pretty good favorite to at least reach the Eastern Conference Finals next year. I think Williams was the untold treasure in that draft. And number two, for a team that did as well as it did, the Phoenix Suns did very well by their draft day. They got Alonzo Tucker, terrific forward from Wisconsin, and DJ Strawberry, Daryl Strawberry's son, from Maryland, which gives them more flexibility because they seem to want to rid themselves of the perennially unhappy Sean Marion.
Big baseball news this week. Frank Thomas became the 21st player to hit 500 career home runs, and Craig Biggio became the 27th to gather career hit number 3,000. But Biggio's working on another record, too.
Well, first of all, let's deal with Frank Thomas, who celebrated this wonderful milestone in his career by getting thrown out of the game. He was so happy he got run. I think he was just personally going back to take congratulatory phone calls at his locker myself. Yes, Craig Biggio. At 283 times hit by a pitch, only four behind Hall of Famer Huey Jennings, who has held that record for an awfully
long time. I'm not sure what to ask you, Charlie, regarding Chris Benoit, the former professional wrestler who killed his son and his wife over the weekend before killing himself. Since the murder-suicide, several publications have run stories about the number of professional wrestlers who have died young of drug-related causes. Will the Benoit story change the perception of this alleged sport?
I thought so at the moment because I thought this was going to turn into one of those CNN news events that goes on for 3 or 4 months. Now I'm less sure than that. It seems to have fallen off the radar a little bit. There's a lot of reasons why this could have happened, the primary one being that Chris Benoit was just sort of an evil guy. There's certainly steroid talk. There's talk about damage to his brain that may have been done. He seemed to be one of these guys who gloried in getting hit over the head with things. The roid rage argument rings just a tiny bit false to me because these horrible events took place over a considerable amount of time. And as was said of Jean Harris, the famous murderer of the Scarsdale Diet Doctor, you know, she had me till the fifth bullet. I mean, I'll give you roid rage. I'll give you a certain percentage of this. Something else was at work here, too. Unless it gets Congress looking up close and personal to the way the WWE does business, I'm not exactly sure what happens to the WWE, which is already being pressed by the equally violent and somewhat more legitimate Ultimate Fighting Sports.
Charlie, we've discussed the grievance that many disabled former NFL players have against the league for not helping them out. This week, some of those retired players took their case to Congress. Good idea?
Yeah. I mean, it's the only place they're going to get a hearing because NFL management, as witnessed by NFL management's performance in front of Congress, doesn't think there's a problem or thinks the system is working perfectly fine. I think, you know, there are a number of different things that can happen. First of all, the NFL has got to stop being celebrated for the fact it doesn't have guaranteed money, which all the fans think is a wonderful thing, because it creates in that sport a culture of disposability, at the end of which you end up with people like Mike Webster.
Wimbledon has many days yet to run, but already controversy has arisen. Spaghetti costs $25 a plate. Even if you're a player, that's what you pay, and at least one player has spoken out.
Yes, Murat Safin, who's won $13 million in prize money in his career.
That's a lot of spaghetti.
That's a lot of plates of even overpriced spaghetti. He's outraged that people have not gone to the press with the outrage of the $25 plate of spaghetti. I don't know, Murat. You know, go buy yourself a nice box of Chef Boyardee and go back to your hotel room.
Reasonably priced pasta may be out at Wimbledon, but
there
has been at least one modification of the all-white attire rule.
Yes, lady tennis players can wear red underwear. Tatiana Golovin sowed some confusion by her choice of lingerie. And it's interesting, the Wimbledon spokesman, and I have to do this because it allows me to do my wing commander voice. They were cleared in advance with the referee and advance with the player. On the basis that they are underwear, they do not have to conform to the predominantly white rule. If they are above the hemline and deemed to be underwear and not shorts. So let us go here, you and I, and we'll go and spend a great deal of time running our fingers through the lingerie drawer, determining what are knickers and what are not. Pim's cup, my lad. Rhodesia.
Thank you, Lord Kirchner.
Thank you, Kirchner. Thank you, Rhodesia. Heal the blacks within the five principles.
When the U.S. Women's Open got underway on Thursday, it included the youngest golfer ever to compete.
Stop!
And they keep getting younger.
Not again!
What do you think? Is 12 too young to be matching drives and putts with Annika Sorenstam and Lorena Ochoa?
12 is stupid. It's wrong. Don't start this again. Somebody please go to Michelle Wie, now residing at the Jennifer Capriati suite, wherever it is that athletes who are over the hill by the time they're 20 go, no, stop, i.e.,
you know, it's a funny thing about the sport of extreme ironing. It seems that every time you're sure that it can't get more extreme...
It does! Explorer scouts were able to paddle 200 meters along the River Ribble from Edsford Bridge while... Actually, I'm slipping back into the voice again.
I'm a good little doggy.
Along the River Ribble from the Edsford Bridge while ironing. And they have wonderful pictures of this little guy with a helmet on an ironing board, ironing the pants while they go. Very nicely done. Well played.
Well played.
And finally, I've got a Milwaukee story for you, Charlie, and it involves the development of an article of attire that will delight any sports fan who's ever wondered how he or she is supposed to clap for a great play and hold on to a beer at the same time. How do you like the beer pouch hoodie?
As we all know, hoodies have the little thing for your hands to go in when you want to warm them
Not
up right
this
in your
one.
Stomach. They have that, but on top of it, they have a little tiny pouch where all of you marsupial drunkards can put your beer while you applaud. Now, we were going to talk earlier about how Yi Jin Lin, the Chinese star, doesn't want to play in Milwaukee. Yi! Beer-holding hoodies!
Take a look at
you
this.
Don't have that in Shanghai, babe! Well played! Well played, Milwaukee! I'm a good little doggy.
Charlie Pierce, who spent four formative years in Milwaukee, writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. I thank you, Charlie.
Well played, old boy.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. On Sunday, under blue skies cooled by intermittent breezes, Johnny Cassolo, a wiry, athletic-looking gentleman who used to sell Hondas, prepares to drive a golf ball off the first tee of the Mount Kisco Country Club in Westchester County, New York.
Good ball, Johnny.
Okay, John.
The gallery's encouragement notwithstanding, Johnny Cassolo's tee shot would not be all that impressive, maybe 130 yards out, bouncing into the right rough, except that Johnny Cassolo not only can't see where the ball has gone, he couldn't see it sitting on the tee in front of him before he hit it. Cassolo is one of the 15 golfers competing in the 30th annual Guiding Eyes for the Blind Golf Classic. After Johnny's drive, his coach, Chris Clark, leads him back to their golf cart, where Johnny's guide dog, a black lab named Hallie, waits patiently.
Yeah, she's a great one.
Does she help you out there on the course?
No.
Of course he's going to say that, right?
The dog's a bigger help than the coach is, for sure.
And this is from the coach?
Absolutely.
Okay.
See, when nobody's looking, I have him pick up the ball and drop it in the hole.
In fact, Hallie was just along for the ride. On the golf course, a blind golfer's coach does the guiding. The coach lines the golfer up behind the ball, positions the club head, warns of the water to the left or the sand trap to the right, estimates the distance to the pin, and then stands back and says clear, so the golfer knows it's okay for him to swing. Except that at the Guiding Eyes for the Blind Golf Classic, the golfer isn't always him. Dr. Angela O'Rourke, a retired Army colonel with several blind golf titles to her credit, was among the competitors in Mount Kisco on Sunday, and her dog, Faith, really is a help out on the golf course.
Well, yes, she is, because she's actually a dual dog. Not only is she a guide dog, but she's a seizure dog. So when I have seizures out on a golf course, it helps me clear out of the fog much faster.
How does that work exactly?
Well, you know, I can't explain it other than, like, when I have seizures, it's like the gears aren't completely working correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of hitting each other instead of into the grooves. And when I love on the dog, it's like a shell of protection comes over me.
It's calming.
It's very calming. Where if a human touches me, the fright or the scaredness increases.
Mm.
But, you know, I just curl the dog. The dog is trained to where if I fall over, she's to come out and lay over by me. Or if I call her, she'll come and lay right next to me, and I curl up and cuddle with her. And it just takes that fog out. You know, and it's awesome.
Angela O'Rourke, Johnny Cassolo, and the rest of the blind golfers competing last weekend have all been hitting golf balls they can't see for long enough so that they no longer regard that achievement as awesome. In fact, they take in stride achievements that make playing golf in the dark seem simple. Consider, for example, Bill McMahon, who lost his sight to diabetes more than 20 years ago. I asked him how his health was these days.
It's not good. I had a very serious fall in October 2005, and you know my back is still affected by it. I broke some vertebrae. I broke 8 bones in my wrist. I broke my humerus bone and damaged my rotator cuff on my left side.
And you're still playing golf. I'm impressed.
I said to the doctor my first day in the hospital, and he told me that I may never walk again. And I kind of looked where he was talking from, and I said, "You don't know me. I'm not only going to walk, but I'm going to swing a club again." And I think he thought I was nuts, but I did it.
Which is not to say every shot Bill McMahon hits finds its mark. That's a characteristic he shares with, among others, Dick Pomo, who traveled with his wife and coach Sharon from Green Valley, Arizona for Sunday's tournament. On the par 3 eighth hole, Pomo's drive was not all he'd have liked it to be.
Oh, off to the right. Off to the right. How did that happen? Well, we'll have to go down and see where it's at.
We moved.
Well, let's go down and see where you're at, my guy.
Waiting his turn at the tee while Dick Pomo went in search of his drive were Johnny Cassolo and his coach, Chris Clark. Coach Clark, with help from Johnny, explained to me that even if Pomo's drive was lost in the woods, it wouldn't be a disaster. The scoring system in this tournament rewards a good hole without penalizing a bad one.
If you make a triple bogey, which is 3 over par, you get 1 point. A double bogey is 2 over par, you get 2 points. A bogey is 1 over, you get 3 points. And then they make a par, 5 points. So you actually, and then a birdie is 8 points. And what that does is it kind of promotes being a little bit more aggressive.
And the other thing, you don't get discouraged because, you know, if you're playing in a regular score, you know, you get a hole, you shoot a 10 or a 12 or a 13, which it happens, you know. Here, you pick up, you go home, you know, that's it, you go to the next hole. So it doesn't work on your psyche, you know.
Very little seems to work negatively on the psyches of these golfers, whereas many golfers, professionals and weekend hackers alike, appear grim as they stride the fairways and have been known to toss their clubs in frustration. The competitors at the Guiding Eyes for the Blind Classic all appeared to be enjoying themselves enormously. I wondered aloud to Dick Pomo, the same guy who doinked that drive into the woods on the right, if maybe everybody seemed so content because last year's tournament was played in cold rain. He didn't think that was the explanation.
We have floated with balls that float and frog gear and scuba equipment. Last year we needed that, but we played. And, you know, you can't be fussy about the weather. If it rains, you play, and if it's sunny, you play.
Well, it's a gorgeous day.
It's beautiful. It takes away some of my excuses.
Well, some of them.
Yeah. I've got more.
Well, you guys are all on an equal footing, though, right?
Yeah. We have to finish before dark for the scorekeeper's sake, not ours.
I'm not sure if they did all finish before dark. I left the course at about 6:30, by which time only 2 twosomes had holed out. One of them included the eventual winner, 74-year-old Pat Brown of New Orleans, whom I met as his son and coach, Pat Brown III, led the victor off the 18th green once he had concluded his round by draining a 10-foot putt. As Pat Brown III took his dad's arm and helped him to their cart, I complimented Mr. Brown Sr. on the sense of drama he demonstrated with that final putt. He smiled and said he had a great coach. Pat Brown lost his sight when a car swerved into the vehicle in which he was a passenger over 40 years ago. On Sunday, he finished with 37 points, meaning that he'd averaged about 2 over par per hole. Brown has won this tournament 17 times, though he says he's not counting.
No, sir. I'd like to get a number and add one after today, but I don't know what the starting number is. I mean, I got an idea, but let's just see what happens today. What's past is gone, you know.
And what was present on that golf course in the sunshine was almost entirely glorious. Almost, because even on the best of days, golf can be hard work. Sheila Drummond, who lost her sight to diabetes 26 years ago, knows that. When she and her husband and coach Keith, who pride themselves on playing quickly enough so that they're often held up by sighted players, finished their round, Sheila was realistic rather than Pollyannic.
We didn't play great, but, you know, golf is a tough game. It's tough for sighted people. It's even more difficult for blind people and competition. I get nervous. I get scared. You know, I'm not a cool, calm, collected person.
Well,
Do I need to say any more?
Perhaps she doesn't, but I will. Sheila Drummond was one of the few competitors in Mount Kisco on Sunday who'd never played golf before she lost her sight. She had to learn everything without seeing anything. When she started playing, her husband was skeptical.
Got me going, yeah. We tried to bowl one time together. That didn't work out so well. And she hasn't bowled with me since. And then she wanted to take golf up, and after she started, she says, you know, you ought to do this. I said, oh, no, you don't. If you're doing it in 2 years, I'll give it a shot. And here I am.
And I hope you're enjoying it sometimes.
Some days we enjoy it, some days we don't, and some days we don't even like each other.
In that respect, at least, blind golf is perhaps no different from golf played by a husband and wife who can both see, except that the blind golf played last weekend wasn't just for fun. The 30th annual Guiding Eyes for the Blind Classic raised a lot of money for the organization that has provided Angela O'Rourke with Faith, Johnny Casola with Hallie, and a great many other blind people around the world with the guide dogs who've enriched their lives.
Sunny skies, don't burn my eyes. I can't see my way to the green. I'm blind as can be, but today I shot a 63. I smell the way to the clear. Have radar that tells me I'm near. I really can't see, but today I shot 63.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Ben Singer, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Chris Clark and the blind golfer whom he coaches, Johnny Casola.
I always say the ball's got to go somewhere, hopefully.
I'll just say to that, duck.
Shouldn't that be four? About the only thing I recall from my golfing days, mercifully. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Sunny skies, don't burn my eye. I can't see my way to the green. I'm blind as can be.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org.